eating as much as we could hold, and carrying back the remainder to be made into tarts and pies. The enormous pantry shelves were nearly filled now with pastries, cordials, hams, and assorted delicacies. "How many people customarily come to a gathering?" I asked Magdalen, one of the girls with whom I had become friendly. She wrinkled a snub, freckled nose in thought. "I dinna ken for sure. The last great gathering at Leoch was over 20 year past, and then there were, maybe 10 score of men come then, when old Jacob died, ye ken, and Colin was made laird. Might be more this year, been a good year for the crops, and folks will hae a bit more money put by, so a good many will bring their wives and bairns along." Visitors were already beginning to arrive at the castle, though I had heard that the official parts of the gathering, the oath-taking, the tinchel, and the games, wouldn't take place for several days. The more illustrious of Colum's taxmen and tenants were housed in the castle proper, while the poorer men-at-arms and cotters set up camp on a fallow field below the stream that fed the castle's loch. Roving tinkers, gypsies, and sellers of small goods had set up a sort of impromptu fair near the bridge. The inhabitants of both castle and nearby village had begun to visit the spot in the evenings when the day's work was done, to buy tools and bits of finery, watch the jugglers, and catch up on the latest gossip. I kept a close eye on the comings and goings, and made a point of paying frequent visits to stable and paddock. There were horses in plenty now, those of the visitors being accommodated in the castle stables. Among the confusion and disturbance of the gathering, I thought I should have no difficulty in finding my chance to escape. It was on one of the fruit-picking expeditions to the orchard that I first met Gilles Duncan. Finding a small patch of Ascaria beneath the roots of an alder, I was hunting for more. The scarlet caps grew in tiny clumps, only 4 or 5 mushrooms in a group, but there were several clumps scattered through the long grass in this part of the orchard. The voices of the women picking fruit grew fainter as I worked my way toward the edge of the orchard, stooping or dropping on hands and knees to gather the fragile stalks. "Those kind of poison," said a voice from behind me. I straightened up from the patch of Ascaria I had been bending over, thumping my head smartly on a branch of the pine they were growing under. As my vision cleared, I could see that the peals of laughter were coming from a tall young woman, perhaps a few years older than myself, fair of hair and skin, with the loveliest green eyes I had ever seen. "I'm sorry to be laughing at you," she said, dimpling as she stepped down into the hollow where I stood. "I could not help it." "I imagine I looked funny," I said, rather ungraciously, rubbing the sore spot on top of my head. "And thank you for the warning, but I know those mushrooms are poisonous."
"Oh, you know.
And who is it you're planning to do away with, then?
Your husband, perhaps?
Tell me if it works, and I'll try it on mine." Her smile was infectious, and I found myself smiling back. I explained that though the raw mushroom caps were indeed poisonous, you could prepare a powdered preparation from the dried fungi that was very efficacious in stopping bleeding when applied topically.
"Oh, so Mrs. Fitz said."
I was more inclined to trust her than Davy Beaton's physician's guide.
"Fancy that," she said, still smiling.
"And did you know that these," she stooped and came up with a handful of tiny blue flowers with heart-shaped leaves, "will start bleeding?"
"No,"
I said, startled. "Why would anyone want to start bleeding?" She looked at me with an expression of exasperated patience.
"To get rid of a child you don't want, I mean.
It brings on your flux, but only if you use it early. Too late, and it can kill you as well as the child."
"You seem to know a lot about it,"
I remarked, still stung by having appeared stupid.
"A bit. The girls in the village come to me now and again for such things, and sometimes the married women, too. They say I'm a witch," she said, widening her brilliant eyes in feigned astonishment.
She grinned. "But my husband's the procurator fiscal for the district, so they don't say it too loud."
"Now, the young lad you brought with you," she went on, nodding in approval, There's one that's had a few love philters bought on his behalf.
Is he yours?
Mine? Who?
You mean, Jamie?
I was startled. The young woman looked amused. She sat down on a log, twirling a lock of fair hair idly around her index finger.
Och, aye. It's quite a few would settle for a fellow with eyes and hair like that, no matter the price on his head, or whether he's any money. Their fathers me think differently, of course.
Now, me, she went on, looking off into the distance. I'm a practical sort. I married a man with a fair house, a bit of money put away, and a good position. As for hair, he hasn't any. And as for eyes, I never noticed, but he doesn't trouble me much.
She held out the basket she carried for my inspection. Four bulbous roots lay in the bottom.
Mallow root, she explained. My husband suffers from a chill on the stomach now and again. Farts like an ox.
I thought it best to stop this line of conversation before things got out of hand.
I haven't introduced myself, I said, extending a hand to help her up from the log. My name is Claire. Claire Beecham.
The hand that took mine was slender, with long, tapering white fingers, though I noticed the tips were stained, probably with the juices of the plants and berries resting alongside the mallow roots in her basket.
"I know who you are," she said. "The village has been humming with talk of you since you came to the castle."
"My name is Gillis. Gillis Duncan." She peered into my basket.
"If it's Balgam Bucrach you're looking for, I can show you where they grow best."
I accepted her offer, and we wandered for some time through the small glens near the orchard, poking under rotted logs and crawling around the rim of the sparkling tarns where the tiny toadstools grew in profusion. Gillis was very knowledgeable about the local plants and their medicinal uses, though she suggested a few usages I thought questionable, to say the least. I thought it very unlikely, for instance, that bloodwort would be effective in making warts grow on a rival's nose, and I strongly doubted whether wood betony was useful in transforming toads into pigeons. She made these explanations with a mischievous glance that suggested she was testing my own knowledge, or perhaps the local suspicion of witchcraft. Despite the occasional teasing, I found her a pleasant companion with a ready wit and a cheerful, if cynical, outlook on life. She appeared to know everything there was to know about everyone in village, countryside, and castle, and our explorations were punctuated by rests, during which she entertained me with complaints about her husband's stomach trouble and amusing, if somewhat malicious, gossip. "They say young Hamish is not his father's son," she said at one point, referring to Colum's only child, the red-haired lad of 8 or so, whom I had seen at dinner in the hall. I wasn't particularly startled by this bit of gossip, having formed my own conclusions on the matter. I was only surprised that there was but one child of questionable parentage, surmising that Letitia had either been lucky or smart enough to seek out someone like Geely in time. Unwisely, I said as much to Geely. She flung back her long, fair hair and laughed. "No, not me. The fair Letitia doesn't need any help in such matters, believe me. If people are seeking a witch in this neighbourhood, they'd do better to look in the castle than the village." Anxious to change the subject to something safer, I seized on the first thing that came to mind. "If young Hamish isn't Colum's son, whose is he supposed to be?" I asked, scrambling over a heap of boulders. "Why, the lad's, of course." She turned to face me, small mouth mocking and green eyes bright with mischief. "Young Jamie?" Returning to the orchard alone, I met Magdalen, hair coming loose under her kerchief, and wide-eyed with worry. "Oh, there you are," she said, heaving a sigh of relief. "We were going back to the castle when I missed you." "It was kind of you to come back for me," I said, picking up the basket of cherries I'd left in the grass. "I know the way, though."
She shook her head. "You should take care, my dearie, walking alone in the woods with all the tinkers and folk coming for the gathering. Colum's giving orders..."
She stopped abruptly, hand over her mouth.
"'That I'm to be watched?' I suggested gently. "'She nodded reluctantly, clearly afraid I would be offended. "'I shrugged and tried to smile reassuringly at her. "'Well, that's natural, I suppose,' I said. "'After all, these no one's word but my own "'for who I am or how I came here.' "'Curiosity overcame my better judgment. "'Who does he think I am?' I asked. "'But the girl could only shake her head. "'You're English,' was all she said. "'I didn't return to the orchard next day, "'not because I was ordered to remain in the castle, "'but because there was a sudden outbreak of food poisoning "'among the castle inhabitants "'that demanded my attention as a physician. "'Having done what I could for the sufferers, "'I set out to track the trouble to its source. "'This proved to be a tainted beef carcass from the slaughter shed.' I was in the shed next day, giving the chief smoker a piece of my mind regarding proper methods of meat preserving, when the door swung open behind me, sending a thick wave of choking smoke over me. I turned, eyes watering, to see Dougal Mackenzie looming through the clouds of oakwood smoke. "'Supervising the butchering as well as the physicking, are you now, mistress?' he asked mockingly. "'Soon you'll have the whole castle under your thumb, "'and Mrs. Fitz will be seeking employment elsewhere.' "'I have no desire to have anything to do with your filthy castle,' I snapped, "'wiping my streaming eyes and coming away with charcoal streaks on my handkerchief. "'All I want is to get out of here as fast as possible.' "'He inclined his head courteously, still grinning. "'Well, I might be in a position to gratify that wish, mistress,' he said. "'At least temporarily.' "'I dropped the handkerchief and stared at him. "'What do you mean?' "'He coughed and waved a hand at the smoke, "'now drifting in his direction. "'He drew me outside the shed "'and turned in the direction of the stables.
"'You were saying yesterday to Colum "'that she needed betony and some odd bits of herbs?'
"'Yes, to make up some medicines "'for the people with food poisoning. "'What of it?' I demanded, still suspicious. He shrugged good-naturedly.
"'Only that I'm going down to the smiths in the village, "'taking 3 horses to be shod. "'The fiscal's wife is something of an herb woman, "'and has stops to hand. "'Doubtless she has the simples that you're needing. "'And if it please you, lady, "'you're welcome to ride one of the horses down with me to the village.'
"'The fiscal's wife? Mrs. Duncan?'
"'I immediately felt happier. "'The prospect of escaping the castle altogether— "'even if only for a short time, was irresistible. "'I mopped my face hurriedly "'and tucked the soiled kerchief in my belt. "'Let's go,' I said. "'I enjoyed the short ride downhill to the village of Cranesmuir, "'even though the day was dark and overcast. "'Dougal himself was in high spirits "'and chatted and joked pleasantly as we went along. "'We stopped first at the Smith's,' where he left the 3 extra horses, taking me up behind him on his saddle for the trip up the high street to the Duncan's house. This was an imposing half-timbered manor of 4 stories, the lower 2 equipped with elegant leaded glass windows, diamond-shaped panes in watery tones of purple and green. Geely greeted us with delight, pleased to have company on such a dreary day. "How splendid!" she exclaimed. "'I've been wanting an excuse to go through the still-room "'and sort out some things. "'Anne!' "'A short, middle-aged serving woman "'with a face like a winter apple "'popped out of a door I hadn't noticed, "'concealed as it was in the bend of the chimney. "'Take Mistress Clare up to the still-room,' Geely ordered, "'and then go and fetch us a bucket of spring water. "'From the spring, mind, not the well in the square.' "'She turned to Dougal. "'I've the tonic put by that I promised your brother, "'if you'll come out to the kitchen with me for a moment.' "'I followed the serving woman's pumpkin-shaped rear "'up a set of narrow wooden stairs, "'emerging unexpectedly into a long, airy loft. "'Unlike the rest of the house, "'this room was furnished with casement windows, "'shut now against the damp, "'but still providing a great deal more light "'than had been available in the fashionably gloomy parlour downstairs.' It was clear that Geely knew her business as an herbalist.
The room was equipped with long drying frames netted with gauze, hooks above the small fireplace for heat drying, and open shelves along the walls drilled with holes to allow for air circulation. The air was thick with the delicious, spicy scent of drying basil, rosemary, and lavender. A surprisingly modern long counter ran along one side of the room, displaying a remarkable assortment of mortars, pestles, mixing bowls, and spoons, all immaculately clean. It was some time before Geely appeared, flushed from climbing the stairs, but smiling in anticipation of a long afternoon of herb-pounding and gossip. It began to rain lightly, drops spattering the long casements, but a small fire was burning on the still-room hearth, and it was very cosy. I enjoyed Geely's company immensely. She had a wry-tongued, cynical viewpoint that was a refreshing contrast to the sweet, shy clanswomen at the castle, and clearly she had been well-educated for a woman in a small village. She also knew every scandal that had occurred either in village or castle in the last 10 years, and she told me endless amusing stories. Oddly enough, she asked me few questions about myself. I thought perhaps that wasn't her way. She would find out what she wanted to know about me from other people. For some time I had been conscious of noises coming from the street outside, but had attributed them to the traffic of villagers coming from Sunday Mass. The kirk was located at the end of the street by the well, and the high street ran from kirk to square, spreading from there into a fan of tiny lanes and walks. In fact, I had amused myself on the ride to the smithy by imagining an aerial view of the village as a representation of a skeletal forearm and hand. The high street was the radius along which lay the shops and businesses and the residences of the more well-to-do. St. Margaret's Lane was the Ulna, a narrower street running parallel with the High, tenanted by smithy, tannery, and the less genteel artisans and businesses. The village square, which, like all village squares I had ever seen, wasn't square at all, but roughly oblong, formed the carpels and metacarpels of the hand, while the several lanes of cottages made up the phalangeal joints of the fingers. The Duncan's house stood on the square, as behooved the residence of the Procurator Fiscal. This was a matter of convenience as well as status. The square could be used for those judicial matters which, by reason of public interest or legal necessity, overflowed the narrow confines of Arthur Duncan's study. And it was, as Dougal explained, convenient to the pillory, a homely wooden contraption that stood on a small stone plinth in the centre of the square, adjacent to the wooden stake used, with thrifty economy of purpose, as whipping post, maypole, flagstaff, and horse tether, depending upon requirements. The noise outside was now much louder, and altogether more disorderly than seemed appropriate to people coming soberly home from church to their dinners. Geely put aside the jars with an exclamation of impatience, and threw open the window to see what caused the uproar. Joining her at the window, I could see a crowd of folk dressed in church-going garb of gown, kirtle, coat, and bonnet, led by the stocky figure of Father Bain, the priest who served both village and castle. He had in his custody a youth, perhaps 12 years old, whose ragged trews and smelly shirt proclaimed him a tanner's lad. The priest had the boy gripped by the nape of the neck, a hold made somewhat difficult to maintain by the fact that the lad was slightly taller than his minatory captor. The crowd followed the pair at a small distance, rumbling with disapproving comment, like a passing thundercloud in the wake of a lightning bolt. As we watched from the upper window, Father Bain and the boy disappeared beneath us into the house. The crowd remained outside, muttering and jostling. A few of the bolder souls chinned themselves on the window ledges, attempting to peer within. Geely shut the window with a slam, making a break in the anticipatory rumble below. "Stealing, most like," she said laconically, returning to the herb table. "Usually is, we the tanner's lads." "What will happen to him?" I asked curiously. She shrugged, crumbling dried rosemary between her fingers into the mortar. "Depends on whether Arthur is dyspeptic this morning, I should reckon. If he's made a good breakfast, the lad might get off with a whipping. But happen he's costive or flatulent,
She made a moo of distaste. "The boy'll lose an ear or a hand, most like." I was horrified, but hesitant to interfere directly in the matter. I was an outlander, and an Englishwoman to boot, and while I thought I would be treated with some respect as an inhabitant of the castle, I had seen many of the villagers surreptitiously making the sign against evil as I passed. My intercession might easily make things worse for the boy.
"Can't you do anything?" I asked gaily. "Speak to your husband, I mean. Ask him to be, lenient."
Gilly looked up from her work, surprised. Clearly, the thought of interfering in her husband's affairs had never crossed her mind.
"Why should you care what happens to him?" she asked, but curiously, not with any hostile meaning. "Of course I care," I said. "He's only a lad. Whatever he did, he doesn't deserve to be mutilated for life."
She raised pale brows. Plainly, this argument was unconvincing. Still, she shrugged and handed me the mortar and pestle. "Anything to oblige a friend," she said, rolling her eyes. She scanned her shelves and selected a bottle of greenish stuff, labelled in fine cursive script, "Extract of Peppermint."
"I'll go and dose Arthur, and whilst I'm about it, I'll see if aught can be done for the lad."
"It may be too late, mind," she warned. "And if that poxy priest's got a hand in, he'll want the stiffest sentence he can get. Still, I'll try. You keep after the pounding. Rosemary takes forever." I took up the pestle as she left and pounded and ground automatically, paying little heed to the results. The shut window blocked the sound, both of the rain and the crowd below. The two blended in a soft, pattering susurrus of menace. Like any schoolchild, I had read Dickens, and earlier authors as well, with their descriptions of the pitiless justice of these times, meted out to all ill-doers, regardless of age or circumstance. But to read, from a cosy distance of 100 or 200 years, accounts of child hangings and judicial mutilation was a far different thing than to sit quietly pounding herbs a few feet above such an occurrence. Could I bring myself to interfere directly if the sentence went against the boy? I moved to the window, carrying the mortar with me, and peered out. The crowd had increased as merchants and housewives, attracted by the gathering, wandered down the high street to investigate. Newcomers leaned close as the standees excitedly relayed the details, then merged into the body of the crowd. More faces turned expectantly to the door of the house. Looking down on the assembly, standing patiently in the drizzle, awaiting a verdict, I suddenly had a vivid understanding of something. Like so many, I had heard, appalled, the reports that trickled out of post-war Germany, the stories of deportations and mass murder, of concentration camps and burnings. And like so many others had done, and would do for years to come, I had asked myself, how could the people have let it happen? They must have known, must have seen the trucks, the coming and going, the fences and smoke. How could they stand by and do nothing? Well, now I knew. The stakes weren't even life or death in this case, and Colum's patronage would likely prevent any physical attack on me. But my hands grew clammy around the porcelain bowl as I thought of myself stepping out, alone and powerless, to confront that mob of solid and virtuous citizens, avid for the excitement of punishment and blood to alleviate the tedium of existence. People are gregarious by necessity. Since the days of the first cave dwellers, humans, hairless, weak and helpless, save for cunning, have survived by joining together in groups, knowing, as so many other edible creatures have found, that there is protection in numbers. And that knowledge, bred in the bone, is what lies behind mob rule. Because to step outside the group, let alone to stand against it, was for uncounted thousands of years death to the creature who dared it. To stand against a crowd would take something more than ordinary courage, something that went beyond human instinct. And I feared I did not have it, and fearing was ashamed.
It seemed forever before the door opened and Geely stepped in, looking cool and unperturbed as usual, a small stick of charcoal in her hand. "We'll need to filter it after it's boiled," she remarked, as though going on with our previous conversation. "I think we'll run it through charcoal and muslin. That's best."
"Geely," I said impatiently, "don't try me. What about the tanner's boy?"
"All that." She lifted a shoulder dismissively, but a mischievous smile lurked about the corners of her lips. She dropped the facade then and laughed.
"You should have seen me," she said, giggling. "I was awfully good, and I say it myself. All wifely solicitude and womanly kindness with a small dab of maternal pity mixed in."
"Oh, Arthur," she dramatized, "had our own union been blessed."
"Not much chance if I've aught to say about it," she said, dropping the soulful mask for a moment with a tilt of her head toward the herb shelves.
"Why, how would you feel, my darling, should your own son be taken so? I doubt it was but hunger made the lad take to thievery. Oh, Arthur, can you no find it in your heart to be merciful, and you the soul of justice?"
She dropped onto a stool, laughing and pounding her fist lightly against her leg. "What a pity there's no place for acting here."
The sound of the crowd outside had changed, and I moved to the window to see what was happening, ignoring Geely's self-congratulations. The throng parted, and the tanner's lad came out, walking slowly between priest and judge. Arthur Duncan was swollen with benevolence, bowing and nodding to the more eminent members of the assembly. Father Bain, on the other hand, resembled a sullen potato more than anything else, brown-faced lumpy with resentment. The little procession proceeded to the centre of the square, where the village locksman, one John McCrae, stepped out of the crowd to meet them. This personage was dressed, as befitted his office, in the sober elegance of dark breeches and a coat and grey velvet hat, removed for the nonce and tenderly sheltered from the rain beneath the tail of his coat. He was not, as I had at first assumed, the village jailer, though in a pinch he did perform such office. His duties were primarily those of constable, customs inspector, and, when needed, executioner. His title came from the wooden lock or scoop that hung from his belt, with which he was entitled to take a percentage of each bag of grain sold in the Thursday market. The remuneration of his office. I had found all this out from the locksman himself. He had been to the castle only a few days before to see whether I could treat a persistent felon on his thumb. I had lanced it with a sterile needle and dressed it with poplar bud salve, finding McCrae a shy and soft-spoken man with a pleasant smile. There was no trace of a smile now, though. McCrae's face was suitably stern. Reasonable, I thought. No one wants to see a grinning executioner. The miscreant was brought to stand on the plinth in the centre of the square. The lad looked pale and frightened, but didn't move as Arthur Duncan, procurator fiscal for the parish of Cranesmuir, drew his plumpness up into an approximation of dignity and prepared to pronounce sentence.
"The ninny had already confessed by the time I came in," said a voice by my ear.
Geely peered interestedly over my shoulder. "I couldn't get him freed entirely. I got him off as light as could be, though. Only an hour in the pillory, and one ear nailed."
"One ear nailed? Nailed to what?"
"Why, the pillory, of course." She shot me a curious look, but turned back to the window to watch the execution of this light sentence obtained by her merciful intercession. The crush of bodies around the pillory was so great that little of the miscreant could be seen, but the crowd drew back a bit to allow the locksman free movement for the ear nailing. The lad, white-faced and small in the jaws of the pillory, had both eyes tight shut and kept them that way, shuddering with fear. He uttered a high, thin scream when the nail was driven in, audible through the closed windows, and I shuddered a bit myself. We returned to our work, as did most of the spectators in the square, but I couldn't help rising to glance out from time to time. A few idlers passing by pause to jeer at the victim and throw balls of mud, and now and then a more sober citizen was to be seen, seizing a moment from the round of daily duties, to attend to the moral improvement of the delinquent by means of a few well-chosen words of reproval and advice. It was still an hour to the late spring sunset, and we were drinking tea below in the parlour, when a pounding at the door announced the arrival of a visitor. The day was so dark from the rain that one could hardly tell the level of the sun. The Duncan's house, however, boasted a clock, a magnificent contrivance of walnut panels, brass pendulums, and a face decorated with choiring cherubim, and this instrument pointed to 6:30. The scullery maid opened the door to the parlour and unceremoniously announced, "In here." Jamie McTavish ducked automatically as he came through the door, bright hair darkened by the rain to the colour of ancient bronze. He wore an elderly and disreputable coat against the wet, and carried a riding cloak of heavy green velvet, folded under one arm. He nodded in acknowledgement as I rose, and introduced him to Geely. "Mr. Duncan? Mrs. Beecham." He waved a hand toward the window. "I see you've had a wee bit doing this afternoon." "Is he still there?" I asked, peering out. The boy was only a dark shape seen through the distortion of the wavering drawing-room panes. "He must be soaked through."
"He is."
Jamie spread the cloak and held it for me.
"So you'd be as well," Colum thought. "I'd business in the village, so he sent along the cloak with me for you. You're to ride back, Weema."
That was kind of him. I spoke absently, for my mind was still on the tanner's lad. "How long must he stay there?" I asked Geely. "The lad in the pillory," I added impatiently, seeing her blank look.
"Oh, him," she said,
frowning slightly at the introduction of such an unimportant topic. "An hour, I told you. The locksman should have freed him from the pillory by now."
"He has," Jamie assured her. "I saw him as I was crossing the green. It's only the lad's not got up courage to tear the gris from his lug yet."
My mouth dropped open. "You mean the nail won't be taken out of his ear? He's to tear himself loose?"
"Oh, aye."
Jamie was cheerfully offhand.
"He's still a bit nervous, but I imagine he'll set his mind to it soon. It's wet out and growing dark as well. We must leave ourselves or we'll get naught but scraps to our dinner."
He bowed to Geely and turned to go.
"Wait a bit," she said to me. "Since you've a big, strong lad like yon to see you home, I've a chest of dried mashed cabbage and other simples as I've promised to Mrs. Fitzgibbons up at the castle. Perhaps Mr. McTavish would be so kind."
Jamie assenting, she had a manservant fetch down the chest from her workroom, handing over the enormous wrought-iron key for the purpose. While the servant was gone, she busied herself for a moment at a small writing-desk in the corner. By the time the chest, a sizable wooden box with brass bands, was brought in, she had finished her note. She hastily sanded it, folded and sealed it with a blob of wax from the candle, and pressed it into my hand. "There," she said, "that's the bill for it. Will you give it to Dougal for me? It's him that handles the payments and such. Dinna give it to anyone else, or I'll not be paid for weeks."
"Yes, of course."
She embraced me warmly, and with admonitions about avoiding the chill, saw us to the door. I stood sheltering beneath the eave of the house as Jamie tied the box to his horse's saddle. The rain was coming down harder now, and the eaves ran with a ragged sheet of water. I eyed the broad back and muscular forearms as he lifted the heavy box with little apparent effort. Then I glanced at the plinth, where the tanner's boy, in spite of encouragement from the regathered crowd, was still firmly pinioned. Granted, this was not a lovely young girl with moonbeam hair, but Jamie's earlier actions in Colum's Hall of Justice made me think that he might not be unsympathetic to the youngster's plight. "Mr. McTavish?" I began hesitantly. There was no response. The comely face didn't change expression. The wide mouth stayed relaxed, the blue eyes focused on the strap he was fastening.
Jamie? I tried again, a little louder, and he looked up at once. So it really wasn't McTavish. I wondered what it was.
Aye,
he said. You're, quite sizable, aren't you? I said. A half-smile curved his lips, and he nodded, clearly wondering what I was up to.
Big enough for moose things, he answered.
I was encouraged, and moved casually closer so as not to be overheard by any stragglers from the square. And tolerably strong in the fingers? I asked. He flexed one hand, and the smile widened.
Aye, that's so. Happen you've a few chestnuts you want cracked.
He looked down at me with a shrewd and merry glint. I glanced briefly past him to the knot of onlookers in the square. More like one to be pulled from the fire, I think. I looked up to meet that questioning blue gaze. Could you do it? He stood looking down at me for a moment, still smiling, then shrugged.
Aye, if the shank's long enough to grip. Can you draw the crowd away, though? Interference wouldn't be looked on kindly, and me a stranger.
I hadn't anticipated the possibility that my request might put him in any danger, and I hesitated. But he seemed game to try, danger notwithstanding. Well, if we both went over for a closer look, and then I were to faint at the sight, do you think...
You being so unused to blood and all.
One brow lifted sardonically, and he grinned.
Aye, that'll do. If you can make shift to fall off the plinth, still better.
I had, in fact, felt a bit squeamish about looking, but it was not so daunting a sight as I had feared. The ear was pinned firmly through the upper flange, close to the edge, and a full 2 inches of the nail's square, headless shank was free above the pinioned appendage. There was almost no blood, and it was clear from the boy's face that while he was both frightened and uncomfortable, he was in no great pain. I began to think that Gilly perhaps had been right in considering this a fairly lenient sentence, given the overall state of current Scottish jurisprudence, though this didn't alter by one whit my opinion as to the barbarity of it. Jamie edged casually through the fringe of lookers-on. He shook his head reprovingly at the boy.
"Now then, lad," he said, clicking his tongue. "Got yourself in a rare swivet, have you know?"
He rested one large, firm hand on the wooden edge of the pillory, under pretext of looking more closely at the ear.
"Och, laddie," he said disparagingly, "yon's no job to be making heavy weather of. A wee snatch o' the head, and it's over. Here, shall I help you?"
He reached out as though to grasp the lad by the hair and wrench his head free. The boy yelped in fear. Recognizing my cue, I stepped back, taking care to tread heavily on the toes of the woman behind me, who yipped in anguish as my boot heel crushed her metatarsals. "Beg your pardon," I gasped. "I'm so dizzy. Please." I turned away from the pillory and took 2 or 3 steps, staggering artfully and clutching at the sleeves of those nearby. The edge of the plinth was only 6 inches away. I took a firm hold on a slightly built girl I had marked out for the purpose and pitched headfirst over the edge, taking her with me. We rolled on the wet grass in a tangle of skirts and squeals. Letting go of her blouse at last, I relaxed into a dramatically spread-eagled heap, rain pattering down on my upturned face. I was, in truth, a trifle winded by the impact. The girl had fallen on top of me, and I fought for breath, listening to the babble of concerned voices gathered round me. Speculations, suggestions, and shocked interjections rained on me, thicker than the drops of water from the sky. But it was a pair of familiar arms that raised me to a sitting position, and a pair of gravely concerned blue eyes that I saw when I opened my own. A faint flicker of the eyelids told me that the mission had been accomplished, and in fact I could see the tanner's lad, napkin clutched to his ear, making off at speed in the direction of his loft, unnoticed by the crowd that had turned to attend to this new sensation. The villagers, so lately calling for the lad's blood, were kindness itself to me. I was tenderly gathered up and carried back to the Duncan's house, where I was plied with brandy, tea,
warm blankets and sympathy. I was only allowed to depart at last by Jamie's stating bluntly that we must go, then lifting me bodily off the couch and heading for the door, disregarding the expostulations of my hosts. Mounted once more in front of him, my own horse led by the rein, I tried to thank him for his help. "No trouble, lass," he said, dismissing my thanks.
"But it was a risk to you," I said, persisting.
"I didn't realize you'd be in danger when I asked you." "Ah," he said, non-committally. And a moment later, with a hint of amusement, "You wouldn't expect me to be less bold than a wee Sassenach lassie now, would you?"
He urged the horses into a trot as the shadows of dusk gathered by the roadside. We didn't speak much on the rest of the journey home. And when we reached the castle, he left me at the gate with no more than a softly mocking, "Good e'en, Mr. Sassenach." But I felt as though a friendship had been begun that ran a bit deeper than shared gossip under the apple trees. Chapter 10. The Oath-Taking. There was a terrific stir over the next 2 days, with comings and goings and preparations of every sort. My medical practice dropped off sharply. The food poisoning victims were well again, and everyone else seemed to be much too busy to fall sick. Aside from a slight rash of splinters in fingers among the boys hauling in wood for the fires, and a similar outbreak of scalds and burns among the busy kitchen maids, there were no accidents either. I was excited myself. Tonight was the night. Mrs. Fitz had told me that all the fighting men of the Mackenzie clan would be in the hall tonight to make their oaths of allegiance to Colum. With a ceremony of this importance going on inside, no one would be watching the stables. During my hours helping in the kitchens and orchards, I had managed to stow away sufficient food to see me provided for several days, I thought. I had no water flasks, but had contrived a substitute, using one of the heavier glass jugs from the surgery. I had stout boots and a warm cloak, courtesy of Colum. I would have a decent horse. On my afternoon visit to the stables, I had marked out the one I meant to take. I had no money, but my patients had given me a handful of small trinkets, ribbons, and bits of carving or jewellery. If necessary, I might be able to use these to trade for anything else I needed. I felt bad about abusing Colum's hospitality and the friendship of the castle inhabitants by leaving without a word or a note of farewell. But after all, what could I possibly say? I had pondered the problem for some time, but finally decided just to leave. For one thing, I had no writing paper, and wasn't willing to take the risk of visiting Colum's quarters in search of any. An hour past first dark, I approached the stable cautiously, ears alert for any signs of human presence. But it seemed that everyone was up in the hall, readying themselves for the ceremony. The door stuck, but gave with a slight push, its leather hinges letting it swing silently inward. The air inside was warm and alive with the faint stirrings of resting horses. It was also black as the inside of an undertaker's hat, as Uncle Lamb used to say. Such few windows as there were for ventilation were narrow slits, too small to admit the faint starlight outside. Hands outstretched, I walked slowly into the main part of the stable, feet shuffling in the straw. I groped carefully in front of me, looking for the edge of a stall to guide me. My hands found only empty air, but my shins met a solid obstruction resting on the floor, and I pitched headlong with a startled cry that rang in the rafters of the old stone building. The obstruction rolled over with a startled oath and grasped me hard by the arms. I found myself held against the length of a sizable male body, with someone's breath tickling my ear.
"Who are you?" I gasped, jerking backward. "And what are you doing here?"
Hearing my voice, the unseen assailant relaxed his grip.
"I might ask the same of you, Sassenach," said the deep, soft voice of Jamie MacTavish, and I relaxed a little in relief.
There was a stirring in the straw, and he sat up.
"Though I suppose I could guess," he added dryly. "How far do you think you'd get, lassie, on a dark night and a strange horse with half the Mackenzie clan after you by morning?"
I was ruffled,
in more ways than one. They wouldn't be after me. They're all up at the hall. And if one in five of them is sober enough to stand by morning, let alone ride a horse, I'll be most surprised. He laughed, and standing up, reached down a hand to help me to my feet. He brushed the straw from the back of my skirt with somewhat more force than I thought strictly necessary.
"Well, that's very sound reasoning on your part, Sassenach," he said,
sounding mildly surprised that I was capable of reason.
"Or would be," he added, "did Colum not have guards posted all round the castle and scattered through the woods? He'd hardly leave the castle unprotected, and the fighting men of the whole clan inside it. Granted, that stone doesn't burn so well as wood."
I gathered he was referring to the infamous Glencoe massacre, when one John Campbell, on government orders, had put 38 members of the MacDonald clan to the sword and burned the house above them. I calculated rapidly. That would have been only 50-some years before, recent enough to justify any defensive precautions on Colum's part.
"In any case, you could scarcely have chosen a worse night to try to escape,"
MacTavish went on. He seemed entirely unconcerned with the fact that I had meant to escape, only with the reasons why it wouldn't work, which struck me as a little odd.
"Besides the guards and the fact that every good horseman for miles around is here, the way to the castle will be filled with folk coming from the countryside for the tinchel and the games."
"Tinchel?"
"A hunt. Usually stags. Maybe a boar this time. One of the stable lads told old Alec there's a large one in the east wood."
He put a large hand in the centre of my back and turned me toward the faint oblong of the open door.
"Come along," he said. "I'll take you back up to the castle."
I pulled away from him. "Don't bother," I said ungraciously. "I can find my own way." He took my elbow with considerable firmness.
"I dare say you can. But you'll not want to meet any of Colum's guards alone."
"And why not?" I snapped. "I'm not doing anything wrong. There's no law against walking outside the castle, is there?"
"No. I doubt they'd mean to do you harm," he said,
peering thoughtfully into the shadows.
"But it's far from unusual for a man to take a flask along to keep him company when he stands guard. And the drink may be a boon companion, but it's no a very good adviser as to suitable behaviour when a small, sweet lass comes on ye alone in the dark."
"I came on you in the dark, alone," I reminded him with some boldness. "And I'm neither particularly small nor very sweet, at least at present."
"Aye, well, I was asleep, not drunk," he responded briefly. "And, questions of your temper aside, you're a good bit smaller than most of Colum's guards."
I put that aside as an unproductive line of argument and tried another tack. "And why were you asleep in the stable?" I asked. "Haven't you a bed somewhere?" We were in the outer reaches of the kitchen gardens by now, and I could see his face in the faint light. He was intent, checking the stone arches carefully as we went, but he glanced sharply aside at this.
"Aye," he said.
He continued to stride forward, still gripping me by the elbow, but went on after a moment.
"I thought I'd be better out of the way."
"Because you don't mean to swear allegiance to Colum Mackenzie," I guessed. "And you don't want to stand any racket about it?" He glanced at me, amused at my words.
"Something like that," he admitted.
One of the side gates had been left welcomingly ajar, and a lantern, perched atop the stone ledge next to it, shed a yellow glow on the path. We had almost reached this beacon, when a hand suddenly descended on my mouth from behind, and I was jerked abruptly off my feet. I struggled and bit, but my captor was heavily gloved, and, as Jamie had said, a good deal larger than I. Jamie himself seemed to be having minor difficulties, judging from the sound of it. The grunting and muffled cursing ceased abruptly with a thud and a rich Gaelic expletive. The struggle in the dark stopped, and there was an unfamiliar laugh.
"God's eyes, if it's no the young lad, Colum's nephew. Come late to the oath-taking, are you not, lad? And who's that wi' you?" "It's a lassie," replied the man holding me, And a sweet, juicy one, too, by the heft of her.
The hand left my mouth and administered a hearty squeeze elsewhere.
I squeaked in indignation, reached over my shoulder, got hold of his nose, and yanked.
The man set me down with a quick oath of his own, less formal than those about to be taken within the hall. I stepped back from the blast of whiskey fumes, feeling a sudden surge of appreciation for Jamie's presence. Perhaps his accompanying me had been prudent after all.
He appeared to be thinking otherwise, as he made a vain attempt to remove the clinging grip of the two men-at-arms who had attached themselves to him. There was nothing hostile about their actions, but there was a considerable amount of firmness. They began to move purposefully toward the open gate, their captive in tow.
"Nay, let me go and change first, man," he protested. "I'm no decent to be going into the oath-taking like this."
His attempt at graceful escape was foiled by the sudden appearance of Rupert, fatly resplendent in ruffled shirt and gold-laced coat, who popped out of the narrow gate like a cork from a bottle.
"Dunno worry yourself about that, laddie," he said, surveying Jamie with a gleaming eye. "We'll outfit you proper. Inside."
He jerked his head toward the gate, and Jamie disappeared within, under compulsion. A meaty hand gripped my own elbow, and I followed, willy-nilly. Rupert appeared to be in very high spirits, as did the other men I saw inside the castle. There were perhaps 60 or 70 men, all dressed in their best, festooned with dirks, swords, pistols and sporrans, milling about in the courtyard nearest the entrance to the great hall. Rupert gestured to a door set in the wall, and the men hustled Jamie into a small lighted room. It was one apparently used for storage. Odds and ends of all kinds littered the tables and shelves with which it was furnished. Rupert surveyed Jamie critically, with an eye to the oat straws in his hair and the stains on his shirt. I saw his glance flicker to the oat straws in my own hair, and a cynical grin split his face.
"No wonder you're late, laddie," he said, digging Jamie in the ribs. "Dinna blame you a bit." "Willie," he called to one of the men outside, "we need some clothes here. Something suitable for the laird's nephew. See to it, man, and hurry."
Jamie looked around, thin-lipped, at the men surrounding him. 6 clansmen, all in tearing high spirits at the prospect of the oath-taking, and brimming over with a fierce Mackenzie pride. The spirits had plainly been assisted by an ample intake from the tub of ale I had seen in the yard. Jamie's eye lighted on me, his expression still grim.
"This was my doing," his face seemed to say.
He could, of course, announce that he didn't mean to swear his oath to Colum and head back to his warm bed in the stables, if he wanted a serious beating, or his throat cut, that is. He raised an eyebrow at me, shrugged, and submitted with a fair show of grace to Willie, who rushed up with a pile of snowy linen in his arms and a hairbrush in one hand. The pile was topped by a flat blue bonnet of velvet, adorned with a metal badge that held a sprig of holly. I picked up the bonnet to examine it, as Jamie fought his way into the clean shirt and brushed his hair with suppressed savagery. The badge was round, and the engraving surprisingly fine. It showed 5 volcanoes in the centre, spouting most realistic flames. And on the border was a motto, "Lucio non euro." "I shine, not burn," I translated aloud.
"Aye, lassie, the Mackenzie motto," said Willie, nodding approvingly at me.
He snatched the bonnet from my hands and pushed it into Jamie's before dashing off in search of further clothing.
"I'm sorry,"
I said in a low voice, taking advantage of Willie's absence to move closer. "I didn't mean..." Jamie, who had been viewing the badge on the bonnet with disfavour, glanced down at me and the grim line of his mouth relaxed.
"Oh, dinna worry yourself on my account, Sassenach. It would have come to it sooner or later."
He twisted the badge loose from the bonnet and smiled sourly at it, weighing it speculatively in his hand.
"Do you ken my own motto, lass?" he asked. "My clan's, I mean."
"No," I answered, startled. "What is it?"
He flipped the badge once in the air, caught it, and dropped it neatly into his sporran. He looked rather bleakly toward the open archway where the Mackenzie clansmen were massing in untidy lines.
"Je suis prêt,"
he replied, in surprisingly good French. He glanced back to see Rupert and another large Mackenzie I didn't know, faces flushed with high spirits and spirits of another kind, advancing with solid purpose. Rupert held a huge length of Mackenzie tartan cloth. Without preliminaries, the other man reached for the buckle of Jamie's kilt.
"Best leave, Sassenach," Jamie advised briefly. "It's no place for women."
"So I see," I responded dryly, and was rewarded with a wry smile as his hips were swathed in the new kilt and the old one yanked deftly away beneath it, modesty preserved. Rupert and friend took him firmly by the arms and hustled him toward the archway. I turned without delay and made my way back toward the stair to the minstrel's gallery, carefully avoiding the eye of any clansman I passed. Once around the corner, I paused, shrinking back against the wall to avoid notice. I waited for a moment until the corridor was temporarily deserted, then nipped inside the gallery door and pulled it quickly to behind me before anyone else could come around the corner and see where I had gone. The stairs were dimly lit by the glow from above, and I had no trouble keeping my footing on the worn flags. I climbed toward the noise and light, thinking of that last brief exchange.
"Je suis prêt."
"I am ready." I hoped he was. The gallery was lit by pine torches, brilliant flares that rose straight up in their sockets, outlined in black by the soot their predecessors had left on the walls. Several faces turned, blinking, to look at me as I came out of the hangings at the back of the gallery. From the looks of it, all the women of the castle were up here. I recognised the girl, Lear, Magdalene, and some of the other women I had met in the kitchens, and, of course, the stout form of Mrs. Fitzgibbons in a position of honour near the balustrade. Seeing me, she beckoned in a friendly manner, and the women squeezed against each other to let me pass. When I reached the front, I could see the whole hall spread out beneath. The walls were decked with myrtle branches, yew and holly, and the fragrance of the evergreens rose up into the gallery, mingled with the smoke of fires and the harsh reek of men. There were dozens of them, coming, going, standing talking in small groups scattered throughout the hall, and all clad in some version of the clan tartan, be it only a plaid or a tartan bonnet worn above ordinary working shirt and tattered breeches. The actual patterns varied wildly, but the colours were mostly the same, dark greens and white. Most of them were completely dressed as Jamie now was, kilt, plaid, bonnet, and in most cases, badges. I caught a glimpse of him standing near the wall, still looking grim. Rupert had disappeared into the throng, but two more burly Mackenzies flanked Jamie, obviously guards. The confusion in the hall was gradually becoming organised as the castle residents pushed and led the newcomers into place at the lower end. Tonight was plainly special. The young lad who played the pipes at Hall had been augmented by two other pipers, one a man whose bearing and ivory-mounted pipes proclaimed him a master piper. This man nodded to the other two, and soon the hall was filled with the fierce drone of pipe music. Much smaller than the great northern pipes used in battle, these versions made a most effective racket. The chanters laid a trill above the drones that made the blood itch. The women stirred around me, and I thought of a line from Maggie Lauder.
"Ooh, they call me Rab the Ranter, and the lasses all go daft when I blow up my chanter."
If not daft, the women around me were fully appreciative, and there were many murmurs of admiration as they hung over the rail, pointing out one man or another striding about the hall decked in his finery. One girl spotted Jamie, with a muffled exclamation, beckoned her friends to see. There was considerable whispering and murmuring over his appearance. Some of it was admiration for his fine looks, but more was speculation about his presence at the oath-taking. I noticed that Lear, in particular, glowed like a candle as she watched him. And I remembered what Alec had said in the paddock.
You know her father will no let her wed outside the clan.
And Colum's nephew, was he? The lad might be quite a catch at that. Bar the minor matter of outlawry, of course.